and welcome to The Urbanist on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. This week, we bring you a special episode looking at Houston and rebuilding after a crisis.
The neighbors came over from across the street, thank God, and helped me get my dog Lexi and myself out.
When Hurricane Harvey headed to Houston, none of the 6.6 million residents could have predicted the level of destruction. Harvey poured down nearly 9 trillion gallons of water, taking the lives of at least 60 people, displacing thousands, and causing damages of over $180 billion. As the floodwaters retreated, many people were forced to start their lives from scratch. So we're going to shine the spotlight on this city and how urban areas can start to heal after the grieving is done. This is The Urbanist.
What you don't know and what nobody else knows right now will be the magnitude of flooding that will be occurring over the coming days in the aftermath of the initial surge.
We debated on leaving, and then we thought, well, we'll go ahead and stay. And then they said it was going to be a Cat 4.
The floodwaters continue to rise.
I look at these folks. A lot of elderly people live in these houses.
Destroying lives and livelihoods.
The neighbors came over from across the street, thank God, and helped me get my dog Lexi and myself out and my 4 cats. That I was only able to take 1 cat with me and Lexi.
We're putting another 2 feet on top of the 2 feet that we saw today. Those rescues are unfolding. It is a frightening situation happening in Houston.
Either it's happening or it's not, and either we can do something about it or we can't. And I think if there's a chance it's happening, we as, you know, the human race should do something to at least mitigate whatever it is we're contributing.
I'm Manny Fernandez. I'm the Houston Bureau Chief of the New York Times. I've been covering this in 2 areas. I was on the ground in the Corpus Christi area when the hurricane first hit the Texas coast. And then I was also later on the ground in Houston after the really bad floods hit there. So that first moment when Hurricane Harvey hit, I was in Corpus Christi at the water line in sort of the marina area of Corpus Christi. And it was, I guess, wind is the only word that comes to mind. There was just this like powerful, invisible fist of wind that was pushing up against myself and the photographer. As he was shooting pictures, I was observing, and we were trying to sort of pop in and out of our car safely, but the waves were rushing up. There was a street light that came down. It was just this kind of like wall of wind is how I would describe it. There were some locals who were sort of curious and were photographers and were sort of braving the storm and driving around. This is maybe an hour or 2 hours before Harvey actually made landfall. And it made landfall a little bit north of Corpus Christi in the Rockport area. Locals were sort of braving it. There were also a bunch of journalists there. There was a feeling of like, you know, really bad storm is coming. I can't believe it. Look at that. But I think that the scale of what was about to happen hadn't really sunk in with everyone who was there, journalists or non-journalists. After the rains hit in Houston and there was, you know, some really bad flooding, you know, I interviewed a lot of people who were either being helped off of civilian rescue boats or who were being either helped out of them or helped into them. The only phrase that sort of comes to mind is sort of shell shock. People were just, you know, they were talking about being 5'8" and standing in water that was chest high. You know, they were talking about, you know, like not recognizing the streets of the neighborhoods where they live because the water was coming up to the stop sign, as if this like sort of bomb went off. And Houston is a city, by the way, that's used to a lot of rain. It's used to a lot of flooding. There's been, you know, 2 big floods very recently here, the Memorial Day flood and the Tax Day flood that people talked about. You know, it was big news locally. But none of that is compared to how widespread this was. I think I'd say about 70% of the boats I saw on the water were civilian boats, were people who live in the Houston area, or they live way outside the Houston area, or they live in other parts of Texas, or they lived in Oklahoma or Louisiana, and they had boats and they brought them in. You know, those sort of airboats you see, you know, those sort of Cajun boats, the fishing boats, and they were just pitching in to help. On the one hand, it was an amazing sight to see, interviewing these sort of regular guys who just saw this on the news and they grabbed a couple friends and they started driving in and wanted to help people. So on the one hand, it's sort of amazing. And then on the other hand, obviously it raises questions about, you know, how many boats does the Houston area law enforcement agencies have? How much personnel was out there? I mean, I think that everybody knows that all of the law enforcement, you know, statewide was trying to do everything that they could. And I guess the question is, you know, how do you plan again so that there's a little bit better preparation? People still have these 6-foot high piles at the curbs outside of their homes. They're ripping out sheet rock. They're ripping out the carpets. They're on hold with FEMA. They're talking to the, you know, insurance company. They are just sort of turning the page on like the first chapter of what they know will be a long book. They're a little bit sort of resigned to that fact. There's a little bit of sort of optimism among those who just lost property and they didn't have a family member get injured or have a family member die. So I think there's a lot of people who feel like this is just property damage and it's just material goods. And, you know, we're ready to sort of rebuild. At the same token, I don't think I've interviewed anybody who said they were moving out of Houston or they were not going to rebuild their home. I haven't interviewed anybody who said they were done with Houston. Everybody has said, you know, we're going to rebuild our home, we're going to stick around. That actually includes a family that went through Hurricane Katrina and then later on went through Hurricane Harvey. You know, I think that the official line also, you know, is pretty optimistic. I think that officials are still scrambling around. You know, again, there's still a massive amount of debris. There's still street lights. There's some really bad traffic in Houston because some of the street lights aren't working. There's a few roads that are still closed. So I think that officials are still grappling with the effects of it. And there hasn't been a lot of soul searching about what can we do better? And, you know, how should we develop Houston? And should we do something different? And so it hasn't really been, you know, a tremendous amount of that lessons learned type stuff happening, because I think that people are still trying to just rebuild and clean up.
Should part of the conversation at some point be about why these happen and if climate change has something to do with it?
The task right now is to save lives, to do everything that we can to rescue people. The task.
He said, we do water testing every day. That's what we do. He's never seen numbers like this in water that is publicly accessible.
30,000 students, that is a huge number. How in the world are you going to be able to relocate so many kids?
Very soon after that, there has to be a really serious conversation about how Houston rebuilds so this doesn't happen again.
The priority should be building as affordably as possible and as widely as possible because people need homes.
And if the society doesn't respond to the worsening damage caused by storms such as Harvey, if it tries to go on with life as usual, we're going to have, you know, even worse consequences in the decades to come.
I'm Nolan Gray, Policy Director for the Center for Market Urbanism. Houston voters have voted zoning down 3 times. Houston was one of the only cities to actually have a vote on comprehensive zoning. And so in the aftermath of Harvey, of course, a lot of people were looking for answers. And one of the most conspicuous things about Houston is that they don't have this kind of Euclidean zoning. This lack of zoning might actually be an asset for the city as the rebuilding process starts. At the outset, it's important to keep in mind that there were 50 inches of rain, 9 trillion gallons of water. So really, we're talking about the sort of marginal things that could have made the storm a little bit worse or a little bit less harmful. But a lot of people rightfully pointed out that there's been a lot of development on wetlands in the Houston region, and there's been the addition of what's called impervious surface, which are basically surfaces that prevent water from seeping into the ground and sort of naturally flowing away without flooding an area. So common examples of this would be, for example, concrete or asphalt, which is used for parking lots and roads. So as the city and mostly its suburbs have built out, there is more of this impervious surface and there's less ability for water to seep into the ground. So that certainly is, to some degree, a problem. And to a certain extent, this problem is caused by some of the planning that Houston actually does do. Houston, as I said, lacks a lot of this use zoning, lacks a lot of these density restrictions, which is, on the whole, very good, in my opinion. But it does still have parking requirements, which essentially force developers to build a certain amount of parking if they're going to add things like housing, restaurants, or offices. In addition, there's quite a lot of development in Houston's suburbs on wetlands, and so that is, of course, an issue. And going forward, policymakers are going to have to think about the most effective way to address that. There are certainly things that city policymakers can do, and I think it's certainly reasonable to ask in the aftermath of one of these events, what could we have done differently? To a certain extent, 9 trillion gallons is 9 trillion gallons, and it's going to flood every city. And if you look throughout Houston's history, flooding is actually a regular problem. There are certainly things that planners can do on the margins, but as I would argue, zoning isn't really a part of it, and we should also keep in mind that we're talking about sort of the marginal impacts of the storm. 40,000 homes were destroyed by the storm. I think at last count, there were 500,000 cars waterlogged. Most recently, now people are saying something like 1 million. So there's going to be some dramatic changes in Houston, and of course, there's the planning element of making sure that this redevelopment doesn't happen on wetlands, maybe toning down the requirements to add parking, which in turn cause impervious surface. But I would argue that Houston's lack of zoning is actually going to be a huge asset in the rebuilding process. In Houston, it's very, very easy, because they lack a lot of these land use restrictions and density restrictions, it's very easy to actually take existing urban land that might have a single-family home, or it might have a fast food restaurant that's auto-oriented, and convert that into something denser, like a mixed-use multifamily unit, a mixed-use apartment building. And so this is very good, because in the aftermath of Harvey, quite a lot of people are going to be looking for homes, and many of those people might be displaced from areas where we know we can't or really shouldn't rebuild. So in this sense, Houston's relatively light restrictions on urban infill will be a huge asset for the city going forward, and we could see what we've seen over the last few years continue, which is that the city has gradually grown denser as more and more people are attracted to urban living. We have two people sort of talking about this issue. We have Houstonians and a lot of people who are sort of familiar with Houston culture, and we have a lot of outside observers who might understand planning in the context of any other city, but not in Houston. Within Houston itself, this sort of lack of zoning is very well embedded in the political culture. And it's important that when policymakers are suggesting perhaps small regulations that could be smart, to not frame it as zoning, because it's politically toxic. So cultivating this understanding of the benefits of zoning is valuable, especially when it comes to rebuilding, and you're going to have to make sure that it's not hard to move more people into the city to allow more people to live in higher density housing in desirable urban areas.
From a chunky infrastructure point of view, there are very few things that pose as great a danger as a natural disaster. Hannes Lager is the director for infrastructure at ARUP, and he told me how cities have to adapt in order to be able to deal with catastrophes more effectively in the future.
I have to admit, I've been in Houston about a month or 2 months ago, and it was funny. I looked at the city and it's like, wow, it turned into a patch of concrete. And this is probably one of the biggest reasons what happened in Houston right there, yeah? There is no green absorption of water into the ground, right? So Houston is a big concrete patch right now. They're building massive highways, 9-lane, 8-lane highways in both directions. So when rainfalls like this happen, and, you know, let's be honest, a 15-inch rainfall, no city in the world will have no flooding. It will flood. But in cities like Copenhagen, where they had big flooding as well, what happened right there, obviously it drains into the ocean, but it drains into the ground. So for me as an engineer, when I see this, water runs down and needs to run somewhere. In Houston, water cannot penetrate the ground anymore. So I think, for me, when I look at this, there's one of the biggest risks what happened in Houston right there. It's just an urban sprawl. It's just so spread out around that there's almost no green patch anymore. There are not a lot of parks in as well. And when you look at it as well, there's not enough channels that the water can run away. And that's the real big problem in Houston at the moment.
No, I've been to the city as well, and you certainly see when you're downtown that the way that zoning works, you'll suddenly have a skyscraper next to acres of car parking, again, just pure tarmac down there. But what's interesting, what you're saying is, in a way, you don't come at this with a big engineer's solution. You come at it with a modest take, which is kind of actually have places where you haven't built anything, rather than saying, I can solve it by putting in, you know, a huge stormwater drainage system.
Correct. And, you know, let's face it as well, there are cities in America, like you go to Cleveland. Cleveland, for example, built gray infrastructure. There's this combination between green infrastructure and gray infrastructure. Gray infrastructures are big water barriers, they're big channels, they're big deep underground storage tunnels, which I'm not saying you shouldn't build this as well. And in certain areas, probably in Houston, you cannot just build the green park anymore because the infrastructure and buildings are there, but you have to put deep underground reservoirs or storage tunnels in there. But you have to make a combination with green infrastructure. Copenhagen is very prone to floods as well, and it's on the ocean as well. Copenhagen made this very big decision, are we building a gray infrastructure or a green infrastructure? They made the decision to build the green infrastructure, as you would expect from the Danish people. And now, for example, a law in Denmark is when you have a new build, you have to put a green roof in there. You have to build streets in a V-shape where the street will turn into a channel that the water can run into a direction where they want to have to put the water in. And yes, it will do damage, but you put it in a direction where the least damage will happen. This costs an enormous amount of money, but let's just make a zero-sum game here. How much is the damage in Houston? We're going to probably be at $60, $70, $80 billion of damage. This infrastructure project probably costs the same amount, but you have to put it in once. These floods, these rainfalls will happen more and more and more in the coming years. And this is a proven fact. Global warming will contribute to that. There is no question about that for me. And, you know, we can discuss as much as we want. I believe this is a big effect of it. And you have to do this infrastructure project in that respect.
Now, when big pieces of infrastructure were put in, you know, ahead of much of the learning about how climate is changing, so, for example, building dams. If a city is in an area where it's often dry and you need to store water and you can't just do it in simple reservoirs, you need to dam rivers. And that's what happened in Houston. How scary is that for now? Cities, you know, 20, 30, 40 years down the line, when they look at these huge pieces of infrastructure that sit often really on their borders, that they're threatened by now.
Let's put it that way. Why is the dam a threat in Houston? What happened actually there? And that people don't talk about this as well. The dam was built for the reason to prevent floods, an absolutely right thing in the 40s and 50s, and it was very cleverly thought through. The problem would happen right there, that's in the back of that dam, about 5, 6, 7 miles upstream. The natural habitat was destroyed and it was rebuilt by urbanization. So all the runoffs, which normally didn't go into this because they were absorbed by the ground, ran into the dam. They're running into the dam right now. So this excess water doesn't go into the ground anymore, it goes into the dam. That's actually the problem. It's not the threat of the stability, it's the threat of, I call it stupid planning, that suddenly much more water goes in there and threatens this infrastructure. So what we have to think about it in existing infrastructure right now to protect this asset, to make it resilient, is actually to think about urban planning, not build another higher dams, bigger dams. And yes, you need to build these dams, as you said rightly, to bring in water into the city. But I think it's about resiliency, it's about clever alternative thinking right now. I think that's important.
So if Houston asked you to come and see City Hall and they were going to take some advice from Arup, you've made it clear that there are some problems that may now be almost insurmountable. But would your menu of things start with then, okay, tear up some of these car parks, make more parks, make more places, yes, to let the water run away?
Absolutely. I 100% believe in this. I think there's also, you know, the damage in Houston is obviously we have flood zones. And, you know, it's very clearly demonstrated that these flood zones have been completely ignored by developments, right? So if you have to be honest, you have to go there, tear this development down, move out of flood zone, develop new flood zones as well for 100-year floods, for 500-year floods, you know? People didn't want to talk about 500-year floods. We had three events of like this in 15, 16, and 17 in Houston, which are 500-year events. So to go back to Houston, you have to rezone it. You probably have to put critical infrastructure in right now, meaning probably building reservoirs right now to have a quick fix. But this is only a quick fix. You have to be a long-term fix. You have to start make people think differently how to do this. And for me, a green infrastructure is the logical way to do it, because concrete is already, the big piles of concrete and slabs of concrete are the problem. What's the point of building more concrete? We have to build parks. We have to put new drainage channels. We have to put the water in the right direction and probably develop areas where the least damage is going to be done in Houston. That's what I would advise the government of Houston right now.
You're involved with the building of metros and subways and so much underground infrastructure, which oddly rarely gets flooded. How come the subway isn't turned into a river when these huge events happen?
Have you been to New York after Sandy?
Well, maybe after Sandy. But strangely, is it because they are just so well constructed?
Because we are flood preventing the whole thing. We have done metros around the world where we have to flood prevention in the entrances. You close the system off. You know, it's basically a concealed system. That's what it is. But we have flooding in metros. I know a research thing, a project we did in Japan, we had in Tokyo where we flooded the subway. And then the Tokyo government built massive underground reservoirs. If that happens, they divert all these flows into these huge underground tanks because Tokyo is just so congested. You have to do it right there. We've seen the same thing in India. They had flooding in the metro as well. You have to. But you cannot prevent it.
So a lot of the work that you do at ARUP is actually looking at those points of potential failure and what would happen to all these incredible pieces of infrastructure that you're building.
Absolutely. And I think we have a very strong focus at the moment in ARUP as well on the resiliency of cities. We believe that one of the biggest threats of humankind will be the resiliency, will be the impact of global warming, of the weather changing right now. I think we have to be much more clever in how we design our cities. I think it's important. Our cities are growing enormously. Just look at the last 10, 15 cities, the biggest cities in the world, where they are. And, you know, I think five or six are just in India or China. And we really have to make the city full and resilient against these catastrophic events like flooding, like, you know, even heat. We have to be much more clever in building this infrastructure. And Houston is a great example in a very sad way that if we don't start thinking in a resilient way, what damage it does to us, actually.
Well, that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and was researched by Charles McFarlane and also by Daphne Karnesis. And it was edited by Christy Evans. Tune in on Monday when a brand new edition of Tall Stories comes out. And also remember to subscribe to ensure that you don't miss out on any new episodes. And also pick up Monocle the magazine, because we're always covering good infrastructure and urbanist stories there too. To play you out of this episode, however, here's Duke Boy Bonner with Houston, the Action Town. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
Man, if you're looking for action. Man, Houston's a town. They got women folk walking down the street. Boy, flagging the men folks down.